Remember when I said everybody said on the astral plane there's too many dimensions and they need to focus so they come here? And you said, well, that's like here. Yeah, the mind is meant to separate things out because it's part of our sensory complex. The eye is one part. So, you know, I want the butter, hand me the butter, you know? And so you do that. But we don't understand that, with this Krishnamurti's point, that we expand, enlarge, and confuse that little mental function into something else, which becomes ideology and then problems.
Yes.
And how do you make someone become aware of a useful instrument, but become aware of what its limitations serve and disservice? I always considered that I was doing Krishnamurti, and I wrote in my essay that led to Crystal's thesis, which led me being out there. I said, McLuhan updated Krishnamurti. Because Krishnamurti is trying to make you aware of the mind. We'll call it the first nature mind in here, which is a mystery still, but we use it. Now we've extended the mind. That squares the confusion. And so McLuhan went past Krishnamurti. He says, well, yeah, there is the hypnosis of the mind, but we've extended. So we got two problems. And let's deal with the later problem first before we get back to what our organic mind is.
Don't you have the same problem that Krishnamurti had when you're doing that, because people don't want to go to what you're doing,
that's right.
Which he's trying to get them back to see the state of mind. It doesn't matter what I'm talking about. I'm trying to get you to look at this.
But I would fascinate people because I wouldn't be obviously doing that. I'd be talking about the second McLuhan extended mind and playing with patterns in that. And then eventually they would always, if they got into it, say, well, what about my soul? Or what about, and then they'd suddenly recover their sense of their mind after they got tired of dealing with the mental extended patterns. And then I would be able to go into that part. But I would never start with that.
That's an interesting thing you can talk to Jerry about, too, these mental extended patterns as addictions.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
no,
because you've got all these people addicted to crop circles or this or that or the other thing, and they're real addicted
to it. Is that why you employ the metaphor of the evergreens?
The evergreens are another topic, because a lot of people are into channeling, and they are actually the best channel around, so I always have the best of everything. You want to talk about media studies, you go to McLuhan. Most people didn't know about McLuhan, right? You want to know about top-down conspiracy stuff, the best guy, LaRouche. Most people have David Icke and stupid stuff out there. So I always provide the best source in different ways of looking at reality. And I had the evergreens. I used to play them on the radio. I used to claim that the subgenius Exus, the aliens had come early and met with me, and I taped them, and I would play with my evergreen readings.
So that was a hook for them. Certain elements.
One day in 93, I'd been on the Genesis of the Music, David Porter's show, and Jerry and I went to see Tim Leary speak in some little place downtown. And that was after I'd been with Tim Leary, which I have. I can show you me and Tim Leary and Nelson Thal on a TV show here. I have it in my little collection. We got a TV to put it on, the DVD. But so we went to see him shortly after that. And then after
that, wasn't it on Sunset Boulevard in
might have been
upstairs in a restaurant.
And Leary kind of just leaned up against the wall, very casually took questions after showing his video.
I was there. I had better.
Yeah, that's a new one. There you go. And you remember he showed his little hippie friends made a little DVD about McLuhan and Socrates. Do you remember the thing he showed?
Yeah. He was really starting to get into the
colonizing.
He was getting into the computer thing.
Right? Yeah, he's talking about virtual reality. But do you remember that he showed the video, and you probably didn't know who McLuhan was?
I didn't recall it was about McLuhan.
Yeah, it was all about McLuhan, and we had just done an interview about him. So he was interested in McLuhan, had been, and got retrieved. Hey, but Nancy, listen to this.
I'm listening.
So what happened was, after the show, we were walking around, and somebody mentioned me to the bartender. I don't know how it came up. And he goes, all of a sudden, or maybe he just thought of it because of the discussion Leary prompted. Because I heard this guy on the radio last night, and he mentioned everybody. May Brussel, Krishnamurti, McLuhan, blah, blah, blah. Listen, of all the names I've been dropping in the show. And he says, it was incredible. He says, I love living in L.A. That's what he heard. It's only in L.A. you hear something like that. Yeah. So I walked over and said, hey, I was the guy you just talked about. So then that surprised him, you know. And then we talked a bit. But that was one of my main memories, is he loved the fact that he was watching me trigger off all these different memes, you know, all these different areas of the people, ideas, and he's impressed with this guy who could go anywhere he wanted to go. Oh, you want to talk about Krishnamurti? they would do here. You want to do maybe
yeah.
Director's cut. I'm commenting on what the book was supposedly meant to do, and we've done so many hours, and it's all up on my website. You can hear it. You can hear our dialogues.
Wow.
Many, many hours.
Wow.
Yeah, what is it technically?
Well, after we finished and got up to the
chart,
we'd done 46, we posted right. 46 sessions, which were 90 minutes each.
The early ones a little longer.
The early ones were longer.
Through the book?
Yeah, we read every quote and we comment. And
wow.
He reads it and he stumbles through.
So why don't you put that together as a book?
You mean transcribe all what we say? Well, you want to type it?
Yeah.
And you can edit out some of my more dope
quotes. They create audience attention. You don't understand, we need a dummy so the average person thinks, these guys are
human. What they're talking about,
The thing is that Scott would read it and stumble through. Then I'd discuss it, or he might stop halfway and say, what's that mean? Then when we finished discussing it, then I'd read it through real smoothly, real fast, and you could kind of hear what it meant because you'd heard me explaining it. So I like the stumbling through part because people are listening. If it was said smoothly, they wouldn't be able to keep up with it. But the fact that Scott stumbles along gives people time to stop and think about what has been said, you know?
But the thing is, if you're reading it, you don't need that, because that's you can read it slowly. Right, that's what he's saying. We don't need to make you look that
We're just going to have his commentary.
And add that, and that would make it much more available, because you cannot come to everybody's house like you're coming here to teach us.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I
one student at a time.
I don't come to teach, I come here to listen and study the effects.
Oh, well then... We'll be careful. Be careful of our words.
Yeah, watch what you're doing. I'm studying you. I could bust you at any moment. So the guy I visited, the McLuhan scholar, he's a surfer.
Uh-huh.
He's a good surfer, and he's lived in his family's cottage over the beach, a place called Whangata, Whanga. We'd say Whanga, Mata, Whangata, but the Maori say Fang, W-H is so it's Whangata. So we're in the Whangata beach, go surfing every day. And every now and then, Andrew would want to watch a movie with me to see what kind of Zenocrity. He wanted to experience movies Zenocrity. So he got the Transformers. So he put on the Transformers, which I could have watched on the plane going out to...
I tried to tell you that was a Bob movie when I saw it. I called him up and said, Bob, Transformers, it's all about Bob.
So so Andrew, he's hoping he's going to see Bob in a movie, you know, with Bob sitting beside him in his own cottage. A friend lent him Transformers, ripped off the net, you know what I mean? And so he wanted to watch it, so I, okay, so he sit down. It was unfucking believable. It's literally about the D-cell. It's about me, unbelievable. And like, Andrew was really good. We just wanted to go, see the 22? He was seeing the numbers in the license plate. He knew what to look for, you know? There was all this shit. And it became so, he couldn't believe it. Probably he started to spook him after a while. It was so literally me. And it probably resonated with things we'd done that day. You know what I mean? It was like right there. So that was amazing.
But the end, it shows the ape. A over the AM.
That's right. No, he was going AP. He says, that's AMAP. It was 22 versus 23. The 22 guys were the bad guys, and the other, the 23, they actually had the numbers. And at one point, right behind them is this big code, 322, which is skull and bones. But that is 22 and 23. And it related to Robert Anton Wilson, who was 22. That came in somewhere in there. It was just unbelievable, the Zenocrity. Even I was impressed with it. You know, usually I know this is going to happen. Well, I don't know when it's going to happen, but usually when people tell me about a movie, it's usually that's probably going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just fun for Andrew to... It was fun for me. I'd never seen anybody so Bob knowledge-wise know what to see when it happened. Mm-hmm. Like he was seeing things before me. So, Carolyn, it's actually about machines turning into being humans. They can transform human, terrain, be anything they want, and they fight among themselves. So it's a battle of the parts of the android beam.
Oh, my God.
It's literally that. And but then the AP factor comes in, where the android beam shrinks.
Mm-hmm.
But so there was the bad aliens who were bad machines. They were number 22. They were actually like 22 of them, or they were called 22. It was unbelievable. And the others were the 23 guys. And I think right at the crisis point, the number 22, 23 comes up. It just, so there was the numbers, but the concepts were totally Bob. AM versus AP, and who's going to win.
What's the A of AP?
Android, AM is Android Meme.
Android Meme.
AP is First Nature. What humans think, anthropomorphic, we project in reality, okay. We think the reality is something to do with us.
Mm-hmm.
The anthropomorphic physical, every culture has a content or a paradigm about what they think they are as the center of the universe. It's sort of like saying, the anthropomorphic physical is that part of the human that says, I'm not a tree, I'm not an animal, I'm something else.
I am me.
We're kind of unique or feel something about us, so we're self-conscious, I don't know what you want. The sense of being human.
Self-awareness.
Yes. So I say the android meme, as it shrinks, is recovering humans confronting their own self, because we've been distracted by the extensions of our own self for thousands of years.
And we've lost a connection to the greater life.
Well, we don't assume that. We may always had connection, or we may never get it. I don't make that assumption we've just been mutating within our second nature stuff, right? Okay. And it's all an extension of the original first nature, whatever that is, but we think we are something,
okay.
You know?
Okay.
And we may not be what we think we are, right?
Yeah, sure.
And,
why would you call it anthropomorphic physical?
Because anthropomorphism is you project a human thing into the...
It's a totem pole is anthropomorphic.
Yeah, totem pole that you see in nature. You say animals are representing parts of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a projection by human thinking that there's human aspects in the external environment.
Yeah, people do it all the time with their animals. They give the animal anthropomorphic attributes.
Yeah. And so that's a simple mental projection, which people did probably from the beginning. But these machines and technologies are more complicated projections by humans. You know what I mean? They're extensions of it. Anthropomorphizing is extending yourself into the environment, or responding to it extending into you. So that interplay of cognition.
So it's not just seeing the humanity in something, it's seeing how humanity projects onto the external.
We love our cars and TVs because we think it's us.
Right.
Uh-huh. And Ann and I discovered a whole new thing called parapet, but that's another topic.
Parapet?
No, pets. Media, as they become smaller, like iPhone, little cute thing that has all of it, they're little pets now.
And we hadn't heard from Andrew. He had been on our list for 2 or 3 years. He used to be on late 90s, early 2000s, and he disappeared. Turned out that he had been a punk musician, and back then he would be late 20s, and he was a surfer and all that. He was working in the internet world. He had corporate jobs and different things. And then he started doing his PhD. He went to Ottawa in spring of 2004, the National Archives, started reading the poem by going to other famous people like Hugh Kenner and Ed Hall and Wilfred Watson, famous people in their own right who have archives in other universities. They were corresponding with McLuhan, so he got in touch with them, and they sent all the letters that McLuhan wrote back and forth with them. No one had done that before. And all of a sudden he posts in May, June 2004. He shows up out of the blue 3 years later and he says, "You guys are making fun of Purple. But I've been fucking doing my homework, and Purple is right on." He defended me, you know what I mean? So I said, "Well, this is interesting. We haven't heard from you, Andrew. What's happening?" "So I'm in Ottawa, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Well, I'm going to be in Toronto in August. I'd like to go see the archives. You'll be there in August?" "Yeah." "Well, I'll get a friend, Matt, to drive up there, and I'll see the archives that I partly organized." I've never seen how they laid them out at the National Archives in Ottawa. So I went in there and met him. We spent a couple of days, and he showed me. He prepared a lot of the videos, which it's a bureaucratic process to take out one fucking video. Then you put that in, you sign them, take on another one. He knew I was coming, so he took them all out and prepared it. So we were able to go through a whole bunch of stuff within 24 hours, which was really nice. Then he came to Ottawa, to Toronto in October. That was in August, up there for a few weeks. I go back to New York, come back up to Toronto in October for the McLuhan Festival. And Andrew comes in from Ottawa. He's finished doing his 6 months research there. Now he's going to interview all the McLuhan people in the University of Toronto area. So we became more friends there, and that's when he went and saw Glow at the Drake Theater, you know, the woman who saw Joyce Zappa and McLuhan, you know, that whole performance.
I thought she lived in Europe.
Yeah, but no, but he was there at the Drake Hotel. We had her on the phone, and we did a whole performance. That was my contribution to the McLuhan Festival. So,
on this last trip?
No, in October 2004.
Oh, okay.
So I was able to tell. So I was able to tell Andrew a lot of stuff, and because he had read a lot of the earlier McLuhan that nobody did, he's one of the few people who read a lot of McLuhan. It was really great talking to someone who had read as much as me. So we stayed in touch. Then as he worked on his thesis, 2005, 2006, he would look at the essay that's published by me, my essay in this academic book, comes out of Fordham University. It's called The Legacy of McLuhan. It's about the transcripts of everybody's speech at the McLuhan Conference in March 98 at Lincoln Center in New York. So he's reading my thing, and at first it didn't make any sense, but as he got to understand more and more, he realized that what I'm saying is something that's never been said before, and he wants to make a PhD proving what I'm saying is right. And so that's what he did.
The following is taken from McLuhan, Typing in America. That was written in the 40s, late 40s. It was an early version of Mechanical Bride, which came out in 51. Type manuscript, National Archives. The quote, "An industrial system atomizes, isolates, breeds many things, including narcissism. The worship of one's body as source of," in brackets, "word." He has a question mark.
Because he's not sure it's
working. Yeah, I don't think Marshall did that.
He said a bridge, not
oh,
a
yeah, right
okay.
There. "The worship of one's body is a source of word and distinction. The more completely mechanized the person, the more he flings himself toward primitivism, i.e. nudist, to evict the machine. The Germans are the supreme type regarding the science nudist link. But to go primitive is to submit even more deeply to the Procrustean embrace of the machine with its infinite appetite for firm, youthful flesh, for the machine is the great leveler. The only equal in this respect is nudity. Okay, so there's the quote.
Yeah, it was real confusing to me.
You have a machine environment, and it seems to attack the flesh, so you counter it by sticking it in their face. Look at me, here's my flesh, I take my clothes off. McLuhan's saying, reacting that way to a machine's effect is still seduction by the machine. Mm-hmm. He's saying don't confront it direct on. So, with that idea, that became a postmodern idea in the 70s and 80s about power. Foucault said, don't rebel against the authorities, because the authorities have no authority. There's nothing behind them. They purposely look to act mean so that you'll get mad and react to them. That means they exist. Okay? So if you ignore them and say they don't exist, you're getting free of the battle, which they will always win. The machine will always win.
Didn't the Black Panthers, wouldn't they say, like, I don't accept the authority of this court?
Right.
Something like this.
That would be a mistake.
That would be a mistake? That's not the same
thing. Yeah, because they're saying there is... You're saying I...
They make the statement.
They're saying there is a court, and they're denying it. You still are reacting to the court.
Yeah.
There was no court to deny the authority of.
So this kind of...
This is McLuhan in the 40s.
Okay. So he's saying just don't.
No, just he's saying you've got to perceive the problem differently.
Right. Okay.
So read it again with that in mind. An industrial system atomizes. That means fragments individuals in, they're literate individuals from 1500 to 1800. Okay. Then comes in, that's the extension of the eye. Then comes in kinetic muscle extensions, machines, steam engines, rods, clanking. That's an extension of our muscular structure. That's kinetic sensory extension. So Americans are built more on kinetic space than visual space. That's why Americans don't like intellectuals. Intellectuals are European book people from 1500 to 1700, say. You see? But even though America was built on the book, but it moved into the next technological phase really quickly and created a cultural type that doesn't like hoity-toity print people. It likes sports and muscular and confrontation and manly and muscular stuff, right? You know that cliche, the Europeans always found Americans naive in terms of culture, but that's high literate Gutenberg culture. But there was a new kind of culture percolated in the Americas that was machine culture, which we're good at. So when the electric environment came in, it turned the machine culture into art form, so the American art world moves ahead with Andy Warhol showing that the machine was art form. Mm-hmm. Europeans couldn't go that far. They started to intuit it with Duchamp and Leger and the people turning machines into art form, but they painted it. Warhol took the machine artifact itself, the Campbell Soup kind, and put it in the gallery. So it was the time for America to celebrate its sensory bias, which was the machine world, because it had been superseded by the electric environment, therefore making the previous environment visible. The previous environment had been dominated by Americans, so with Jackson Pollock on to Warhol, Americans took over the art world in the 1560s, because they were better able to handle the machine archetype than the Europeans.
Didn't Duchamp do a little bit of that when he put the urinal up there, the bicycle wheel or whatever?
Yes, and he spent a lot of time in the United States.
Yes, he did.
You know, he went back and forth and maybe spent most of his time in the United States. And he never got trapped in the European ideological art faction battles. And of course, the Warhol and Rauschenberg all picked up what they did and explained it as a historical reference. Duchamp, because he intuited the machine as art form. That's why McLuhan has a reference to Duchamp on the cover of The Mechanical Bride.
That's Duchamp's piece.
Yeah, right? And McLuhan's calling, pointing out the Duchampian ethos, but then taking it further to this. So the industrial system atomizes, so it takes visually literate people and then fragments them even more within the muscular, confrontational, mechanical American ethos. An industrial system atomizes, isolates, breeds many things, including narcissism. Narcissism would be your personal psychology built on visual literate space, and you're going to hold on to that as you encounter the kinetic, muscular, impersonal machine world. So Americans become narcissistic. That's the holdover of the literate part of themselves, literate psychology. They think they're a little, okay, they get atomized, so you celebrate your separate atomized situation by saying, this is the greatest thing that ever happened, me, I'm a narcissist, right? The worship of one's body as a source of word and distinction. Well, let's say we don't know if the word word is there.
Yeah.
Just the worship of one's body as source of distinction means, in my terms, that the chemical body, which is built on industrial technology, is an American model. Americans have been very good at building the chemical body, and it is, when you go discarnate, the only means of distinction or identity is to fall back and really celebrate the chemical body. So that's another form of narcissism. So he's saying the worship of one's body, after he says, including narcissism, he's going to explain narcissism. The worship of one's chemical body is source of word, source of something, status, and distinction. The more completely mechanized the person, the more he will celebrate his chemical body. Mechanized is the beginning of the discarnate state. And not completely. The discarnate is tactile. But the kinetic is beginning to mechanize yourself with cars and machines in the 19th century. The more completely mechanized the person, the more he flings himself toward primitivism, i.e. nudis. In other words, he tries to re-archetypalize, reassert the narcissism of the chemical body. It doesn't need any clothing. It's just the chemical body. My visually biased flesh will stand up against this inhuman machine.
Is an expression of that the piercing, the popularity of piercing and tattooing? And stuff?
That's the effect of the TV. That's a later phase. Oh. That's celebrating the TV body. The tattoos is your TV body. The little stub in your nose or your penis or ear is the chip body, the little crystal. And so the young kids celebrate, I got both. They're telling you got four bodies.
Yeah.
And they abuse the chemical body. It's minor. So they tattoo it, stick things in their tongue and all that. And why would people do that? Well, if you believe McLuhan, there's these different dynamics happening with new technological environments, then the mind would do that.
Why? Why would you abuse your own body?
Because it's not a major body, because McLuhan's right. You have a TV and chip body. So the average kid refers to...
Yeah, but to perceive the chip body and all that, you have to have a healthy body.
No. You live inside that. You live in the space. The chemical body becomes even more unhealthy because you're just putting junk food in it because it's not that important. Because you got to stay on the phone or keep typing.
That seems so complex to me. Because I always,
that does make sense.
It makes sense within
the Bob framework, but I mean...
There's no communication with anybody else.
It's not just the Bob framework, is what McClellan would say. It's actually. He's just explaining that these, when you say it's extensions, that's not an intellectual thing anymore. That's real.
Actual extensions.
I just put new lungs. You got new things to breathe.
I always just saw that piercing and tattooing as just simply a reaction to the oppression of top down.
Rebellion. That's the American interpretation. It's always rebelling and asserting the individual.
Uh-huh.
See that? No, you're thinking in terms of visual literate humanist terms of the 19th and 18th century.
It's a humanist.
Well, he's European.
It's like the right wingers saying the Constitution is everything. A little piece of fucking paper. And Bush, being modern and up to date, says, it's just a fucking piece of paper. What's that to do with the fucking discarnate state I gotta live in and be president of? You know what I mean? I gotta deal with TV.
Yeah, I can't.
Press conferences. Did you get something there, or are you still confused?
You thought
there was superficial rebellion. I'm saying it's way more than that. The kids aren't rebelling. They're merging with the new environments and showing they know about it. McLuhan obviously said TV tattoos your skin and your central nervous system. We call it mind control. But it tattoos. The whole sensorium goes on you. So it's natural that kids who grow up on it, more than the baby boomers in the 80s and 90s, they want to tattoo themselves, an instinctive thing. So they retrieve primitive tattooing of themselves.
Why did the primitives do it?
Because they were half discarnate, because they had not had writing, and they did not live in visual body. They didn't know they had skin. They lived totally immersed in first nature, with cultural... They thought the spirits were still there. They would decorate this little appendage, because they did not have a sense of this appendage, as the Greeks did. The Greeks, with writing, started to put a frame around and concentrate on the skin, and then later in the 1600s...
The Greeks didn't tattoo themselves.
No, they started to show the body. They actually could see a body. Primitive people couldn't see a body.
So they would
decorate. Because that's eye. They were acoustic. They just danced reality and decorated it.
Gee, I'm glad you came to educate me.
Yeah, that's what you...
He educates people one at a time.
Yeah, I do it one at a time. Like Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti did that. Yeah. So,
there he goes again.
Yeah, yeah.
Calling it on
me. Yeah, very history. I'm part of tradition. The more completely mechanized, the more completely mechanized the person, the more he flings himself toward primitivism, i.e. nudis. in this American context, to evict the machine, to get rid of it, to purge it. You've been possessed. But it's an industrial machine.
See, I got confused about that because I confused the word evict it to get it out, and I was thinking of, I don't know how I was reading that, but that really confused me there. So, but you're saying...
Yeah. You, if you understand it's a part of your body, they try to cut off the machine part of their body.
They reject it.
Yeah. They're trying to reject the industrial chemical body.
They want to.
Yeah, yeah. So...
to get back to first nature, but they can't.
Yeah. Actually, to get back to a literate idea of their body, something that they can see. Remember, primitive people didn't even know they had a body.
Something they didn't have to go on TV to validify.
See, that explains shamanism, which we look at. How this fucking guy who sminkles stuff and all the weird stuff shamans, primitive shamans do, we think, oh, how does that relate to body? We don't realize he doesn't have a fucking body. He's playing with sensory milieu, sensory forms, and mutating the patient who believes in the smells. And you know what I mean? It's not a body thing. It's an early version of primitive discarnedness. To playing with the senses. That makes total sense when you think of how we couldn't understand what they thought they were doing. I mean, they didn't even know that sex caused babies. Many tribes, they thought it was all this other multisensual. They didn't know they had a dick going in a quim and causing a sperm. They might have known something that was maybe the pleasurable celebration of it. But they thought it was all these other processes that made birth. Mm-hmm. They celebrated the goddess mother. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They knew it came out. The product came out of the vagina, and they made a big deal out of that, but it had so many other things. They weren't worshiping a body part, like we would think. We see the body part once we get literate.
I'm running out of tape.
Well, I'm almost finished.
It's saying it's quitting.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Let me just finish this.
One more minute.
The Germans are the supreme type regarding the science nudist link, machine nudist link. The Germans build a lot of the mechanical environment. But to go primitive is to submit even more deeply. In other words, get seduced to the Procrustean cage-like embrace of the machine with its infinite appetite to consume firm, youthful flesh. For the machine is the great leveler to early phase of disappearance. The only equal in this respect is nudity. That's the only thing you can think you're denying. I'm throwing my plain physical flesh back on something that's layering new stuff on my flesh.